Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on March 9th, 2019. This is the eighth week of our Saturday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Agantuka Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
For our new Sangha members, I'd like to give a brief introduction. Well, you've heard this before, but this is important. If we're going to develop what Siddhartha Gautama, the man who would become known as the Buddha, if we're going to develop his teachings, it's very important to understand the context in which he taught. The big problem with most modern applications of Buddhism is that they've adapted, accommodated, embellished, or completely dismissed what he taught, even though it's called Buddhism. And anytime the Dhamma is taken out of context or dismissed, there's really no Dhamma left. And the Buddha taught a very simple and effective way of regaining control of our minds and uniting our minds and our bodies and keeping it there. The goal of his teachings, he declared, was to develop a profound understanding of the nature of suffering, human suffering, and through that understanding, develop a lasting, calm, and peaceful mind. To some people, that sounds like it might not even be worth the effort, but that's everything, isn't it? To live your life united in your body with a calm and peaceful mind, not reacting to anything, not needing anything to be different than it is. The Buddha awakened to something known as dependent origination. It's called dependent arising, dependent co-arising. It has different misunderstandings applied to it, such as interdependence and interconnectedness and interbeing. All of those things have nothing to do with dependent origination. Dependent origination clearly states that from ignorance, a very specific ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of human confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory, in a word, suffering, dukkha, occurs. And so it's a lack of understanding of true human reality, Four Noble Truths, that causes all the suffering in our lives. That's probably one of the most, dependent origination is one of the most, if not the most, misunderstood and misapplied teaching in all of the Buddha's, in all of Buddhism. If you go on the website, on any web, go on the internet and do a search on dependent origination, you'll hear a whole series, you'll see a whole series of talks from many modern so-called masters that teach dependent origination in a way that completely contradicts this. And I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. I'm emphasizing the importance, if we're going to develop the Buddha's Dhamma, to actually know what he taught, and that rests in dependent origination. Nothing really can come of a Dhamma practice without at least a cursory understanding that it is from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that all manner of suffering arises, because that points us in the right direction. It gives us the opening for the first factor of the Eightfold Path of right view. Where do I go with this? And so we go to the first teaching the Buddha ever gave, which was called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta that established the Four Noble Truths as the foundation and context for everything the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years. So is that clear, especially to the new folks? And that's just the context. If you keep coming to class, and you can also go on my website to really learn what dependent origination and Four Noble Truths are, although we just touched on Four Noble Truths last week, and we will get to dependent origination in a few weeks in this course too. So the Buddha awakened to that profound knowledge that it is a lack of understanding of Four Noble Truths that leads to all suffering. Those Four Noble Truths are, Jen, you want to go? Because you summarize it so nicely in here.
Suffering occurs. Clinging and craving or wanting the suffering to be different causes or exacerbates suffering. There's a way out of that, and it's through the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, that's the Four Noble Truth. The craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. And that craving is for, just like Jen said, it's wanting our lives or what's occurring in our lives to be different than they are. Think about that. Wanting something to be different than it is insisting that I can change the past, even if it's a moment ago. And if I'm thinking that way, my mind is distracted and it's not united in my body.
Ignoring.
And so we spend our lives, this is, the Buddha couldn't almost as accurately said, declared the First Noble Truth, as there is distraction, as it is the preoccupation with dukkha, the preoccupation with chasing after what we think we need to be happy, and avoiding anything that might take away from that happiness, that is the constant distraction with our lives. So the Buddha's profound and direct teaching unites a mind and a body by teaching radical acceptance. And as we develop the Dhamma, we learn the significant difference between acceptance and approval. As Westerners, and most people in the world today, but particularly Westerners, we have it almost hardwired that in order for me to accept something, I first have to judge it in some way, approve of it, and then I can accept it. When that is just, that creates constant stress in our lives. Things occur. Things will always occur. The declaration that the Buddha said as the First Noble Truth to some people seems almost silly and meaningless because it's so obvious, but we don't want to face it. Dukkha occurs. But if we understand that at its most profound level, we won't react to things that we might have reacted to. We'll maintain a calm and peaceful mind through the concentration practice. And that relates directly to the meditation method that we use and that the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught meditation for the primary purpose of deepening concentration so that through that well-concentrated mind, it can support the refined mindfulness necessary to do a very simple task, to hold in mind the Eightfold Path. So that's where we are today in the class, too. We're at the first week of three on the Eightfold Path, and this week is on the wisdom factors of right view and right intention. Everybody that's taking the course, have you read this chapter? Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So the sutta doesn't relate in a completely direct way to the wisdom factors, but I'll talk more about this. It's such an interesting sutta, because the Buddha describes, not unlike the Magavabhanga Sutta, which is an exposition of the Eightfold Path, this is the Buddha teaching why we use the Eightfold Path and the results of that. And it's important teaching because we can recognize that we're developing the path correctly, which is an important part of the Dhamma. The Buddha's words from the Aghantaka Sutta. Friends, I will teach the value of developing direct knowledge and profound wisdom. That's an important line just relating to the Dhamma. It's direct knowledge and profound wisdom. In other words, it's not something that's bestowed on us by imaginary disincarnate beings or a supreme being or anything like that. It's through direct knowledge, through what we develop ourselves. Listen carefully. Suppose there is a guest house where people from all directions and all professions and positions take residence. In this same way, anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path will comprehend, again with direct knowledge and profound wisdom, whatever phenomena are to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Again, look at the specificity. The phenomena that are to be comprehended, meaning that there's things that we just simply shouldn't bother ourselves with. And this contradicts much of modern Buddhism, but much of the modern world, where we should pick apart and analyze and personalize every single thing that occurs in our lives. In fact, much of the modern, I'm not putting it down, modern mindfulness have brought some great benefits, but in some of its applications, it's simply more of distraction, meaning that we're taught to be mindful of everything that's occurring in a distracting way. And that's not something the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught us to be mindful of very specific things. And that's related in that, what he just said there. Furthermore, they will abandon whatever phenomena are to be abandoned through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. And the Dhamma itself shows us very clearly what is to be comprehended and what is simply to be abandoned. Furthermore, they will experience whatever phenomena are to be experienced through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Again, this is only possible through the Eightfold Path. He's emphasizing the importance of developing that path so that you can have these experiences in the Dhamma. Furthermore, they will develop whatever phenomena are to be developed through direct knowledge and profound wisdom, and which phenomena are to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. So I'm going to give you a clue, then ask you the question. When the Buddha describes suffering, he says that birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Receiving or experiencing what is undesired is suffering. And then he would always conclude that brief explanation of suffering by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. Those five aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. And again, remember, it's not some grand cosmic united consciousness. It's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of four noble truths, rooted in fabrication. So, furthermore, they will develop whatever phenomena are to be developed through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. And which phenomena are to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? The five clinging aggregates. Again, the Buddha taught that the purpose of his Dhamma is to develop a profound understanding of suffering. Why? So we can stop contributing to it. And here the Buddha is saying exactly the same thing. From that personal experience of the five clinging aggregates is to be comprehended. It's to be understood. To many people, when they first come across this, just because it's such unfamiliar territory and it challenges our own beliefs rooted in ignorance, that we have a hard time integrating this or even accepting it at first as a reasonable path. But that's just the power of a mind rooted in ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge its ignorance. Is that clear? And we create very powerful but subtle strategies to do just that. To ignore our own ignorance, including many spiritual practices and many modern Buddhist applications are just strategies to continue to ignore ignorance. But when we apply the Dhamma as it's meant to be, as we do here, we apply it to where it should be, to the five clinging aggregates. So I'm asking, anybody can answer this, but those of you that when you first hear the five clinging aggregates, it was something that you want to hear, right? Mm-hmm. Because you didn't understand it. Yeah. But now you see how important it is to understand that, right? I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth.
No.
And it's not that difficult to understand once you have the proper context. Yes, no?
Yes.
Good.
They're all impermanent.
They're all impermanent. And as the Buddha teaches in the Anattalakkhana Sutta and other suttas, if it's impermanent, how can it be a self?
Yeah.
How can it have any remnant of a self? If it's impermanent, there's no substance.
Yeah.
And so why would I insist that... What is impermanent, what has no substance, go through my life insisting that that's me. It is. It's the ultimate in foolishness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the ultimate in suffering, not knowing who we truly are. Mm-hmm. And again, for the new folks, and to reemphasize, the Buddha never taught that there's no such thing as a self. That's one of the biggest misunderstandings of ever. I mean, that's just ridiculous. The Buddha taught simply that the views we have developed that we think constitute a self are wrong views. They're not a self. That's the Buddha's use of the term anatta. It's our views that don't describe the self accurately. So we go from a wrong view of self, a wrong view of impermanence, and a wrong view of suffering to profound knowledge. These five clinging aggregates are the phenomena to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. And which phenomena are to be abandoned with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? Ignorance and craving for becoming further ignorant are the phenomena to be abandoned with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Again, see the importance of the context. The Buddha awakened to the problem that it is ignorance of four noble truths that causes all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. So the solution would be to gain wisdom and abandon, that initial ignorance. Ignorance and craving. A mind that has developed the profound wisdom of understanding human life won't crave for anything, will it? Because it's always satisfied. Because it understands there's no reason to not be satisfied. To not be have developed that radical acceptance. Somebody who's that to join? Is that Frank? Hey, Frank, how are you? I'll get you on screen a little bit. Buddha continues, and which phenomena are to be experienced with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? knowledge with regards to stress, and release from ignorance of Four Noble Truths are the phenomena to be experienced with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. So there's times where it can be difficult, especially in the beginning, to understand why am I engaged in this Dhamma practice? What's the point? The Buddha tells us right here. The point is to gain knowledge with regards to stress and release from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And how do we do it? Through that Eightfold Path. And that is the entire Buddhist teaching, which again, to a mind that's constantly grasping and needing more distraction, it seems almost too simplistic to even be bothered with. I mean, remember, a self-referential ego self, anatta, a mind that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is always grasping for more, and it's never satisfied with anything, including a simple and direct Dhamma practice. In fact, I might say, especially something that is so simple and direct that it immediately begins to challenge ignorance. Most people can't accept that. They come up with all kinds of scenarios why this doesn't work, or the most self-referential view, it might be good for others, but I can't do it. I'm just too distracted, or too this, or too that. It won't work for me. But the Buddha taught a Dhamma for every human being who was interested in, could develop it and awaken in this lifetime. In fact, sometimes in just a matter of weeks. Remember the Satipatthana Nyanaponasati Sutta? Skip ahead. And which phenomena are to be developed with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? A calm mind and insight into the three marks of existence. Makes sense, doesn't it? And this is, again, a very specific insight. And it's somewhat contradicts the modern insight movement, which is really insight into anything you got going on in your mind. And I'm not beating it up and I'm generalizing it, but the Buddha taught very specific insight into impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and the nature of suffering. A calm mind and insight into the three marks of existence are the phenomena to be developed with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. And how does anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path through direct knowledge and profound wisdom, comprehend appropriate phenomena, abandon appropriate phenomena, experience appropriate phenomena, and develop appropriate phenomena? Through the Eightfold Path. Anyone who develops right view, dependent on seclusion and on dispassion and on cessation of ignorance, that results in release from wrong views. You have a question?
No.
I'm prodding you for a question.
Oh.
What you brought up Tuesday.
Right. What is meant by seclusion?
And Lorna knows the answer.
Should I answer?
Yes, because this is a very profound understanding of, and when the Buddha teaches to meditate, he says, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, meaning establish seclusion, and do jhana. Jhana means to deepen concentration.
It means to deepen concentration, but and it refers to seclusion as in go meditate by oneself, and that's one aspect of seclusion. But he also means to take that seclusion into the outside world, so you're not engaging with phenomena, that you're not getting carried away, your thoughts and your feelings are not getting carried away to experience phenomena in a different way than phenomena really is.
Yeah, wow.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense, thank you. I don't know why you're not doing a teacher training. The holistic nature of what Lorna just said in the Buddha's teaching and proper application of meditation. We first establish seclusion in our meditation practice by taking refuge. Remember the Ratana Sutta. And so we learn to deepen our concentration on our cushions. That's a physical establishment of seclusion if we're meditating in the right setting. But now it becomes an internal or an internalized aspect of seclusion, a well-concentrated mind. So now off our cushions, we take that well-concentrated mind out into our moment-by-moment life. And because our minds are well-concentrated, we are no longer entangled in the world, prone to reaction, and we have established seclusion while we're in the world. Is that clear? That's what Lorna was saying. That's the point. It's not just And this is why the Buddha didn't just teach meditation. It would have been easy for him, wouldn't it, to say, just go meditate, go sit there. You're going to be good. You'll be cool. But the Buddha understood the nature of ignorance at that profound level, that meditation was only for deepening concentration so that we could live our lives framed by the Eightfold Path, free of entanglements with the world, which is an ongoing experience of stress. So an awakened human being, awakening means to gain full human maturity. There's no mystical or magical applications of awakening. It simply means you understand human life. That's the definition of maturity, isn't it? And you're able to live your life with your mind united in your body without the need to approve of anything and accepting everything. Isn't that remarkable? And it is entirely achievable, isn't it? Every one of you has had this experience, even if it hasn't lasted, correct? Mm-hmm. You've been able to reflect on experiences that would have driven you crazy, caused a reaction. And you've realized you've regained control of your mind to the extent that it no longer reacts. That's seclusion in practicality. Okay, important point. Thank you, Lorna. Through direct knowledge and profound wisdom, they develop right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation that is dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, not taking things personally, dependent on cessation that results in release from clinging to wrong views. How much simpler can a direction be to what to do? Develop the Eightfold Path, and it leads directly to this. Now, again, we've talked about this often. When you first even heard of the Eightfold Path, those eight different factors, you probably couldn't remember all of them, could you? And so the beginning is this kind of an interesting intellectual exercise of simply just remembering what they are. Forget about applying them. I remember going through this myself. It's only eight things, but I had a difficult time recalling them, and I'd kind of play little games. Okay, Eightfold Path, what is it? And I might get to five or six, and this went on for a few months. But I could never get them all. But it really wasn't until I could remember them all, this simple little act of memory, that now I could start integrating it, because I would remember in an appropriate way mindfulness. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. And at the appropriate time, I could apply the factors that were appropriate of the Eightfold Path. In other words, when I found myself wanting to gossip about someone, I would remember, wait a minute, I'm practicing right speech. I'm trying to develop right speech. And in that moment, I would practice restraint, where the Dhamma, where the rubber hits the road. Mm-hmm. Restraint is, at our sixth sense base, is where we apply the Dhamma. So in the moment, because I now had the framework of the Eightfold Path, I wanted to talk about someone, and I realized, wait a minute, that's hurtful towards me and towards them and other people. I'm not going to do it. That's a practical application of the Dhamma. And many, many people who start to take up the Dhamma, right speech is the first thing that they start recognizing and incorporating, and that's wonderful, because that's what we do all the time. We're always in relationships with others, or the most important aspect of right speech, the story we're telling ourselves. Mm-hmm. And to recognize the fabrication in that self-story is so important. Getting off a little bit. The Buddha continues. Now, he just told us, the Eightfold Path is the path to cessation. It results in release from clinging to wrong views. That's the point. In this way, anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path will, with direct knowledge and profound wisdom, comprehend the phenomena to be comprehended, abandon phenomena to be abandoned, experience phenomena to be experienced, and develop phenomena to be developed. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you. It's a remarkable sutta in its directness and scope. And imagine or remember the setting 2,600 years ago. Here's an awakened human being talking to a group of his followers, his disciples, and having this pleasant chat. But the Buddha must have noticed something within the original Sangha that required him to say, it's just this. And likely, now I'm speculating, it was because there, even during the Buddha's time, there was this compulsion to adapt, accommodate, and embellish the Buddha's Dhamma. And here he's reminding us, keep it simple, keep it direct, and this is what you will develop. A mind of lasting peace and calm. And that's the beginning of wisdom, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about this Tuesday night, and we often talk about it here. Mundane or original right view is simply the view that maybe I don't know everything, and maybe there's a different way of seeing and understanding the world. That opens the door just a little bit. And then what we allow in is going to determine whether we're going to be effective in developing understanding. And that's where the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, as the framework for developing a calm and peaceful mind and a profound understanding of the nature of human suffering. So there's two talks for today.
I have a question, John.
Yes, Mary.
When the Buddha says to accept what's going on around you but not approve, I can understand that, but I have to do something about it. I mean...
Oh, yeah. There is. It doesn't mean to... it doesn't mean to become a pacifist by any means. In fact, I think a mind that is more well concentrated and mindful of the Eightfold Path is going to be much more effective in making real change in the world without becoming agitated and causing others to be agitated. So I think about this the other day. I tend to watch the news just once a week, but now it's maybe twice a week. It's just too overwhelming, all the awful things that are going on. We don't need to know everything. But it occurred to me that the same issues that we're dealing with today, Siddhartha Gautama was dealing with 2,600 years ago. It just wasn't on a global scale. And there wasn't that threat of immediate annihilation, but they didn't know that either. You know, they were under the same kind of threats as we were. The Buddha awakened, the Loka Sutta is such a telling sutta. The Loka Sutta is the Buddha describing the quality of his mind when he first awakened. And he said, I looked out on the world, and the world is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion. The fires of passion always refer to the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, a self-centered way of living in the world. That's what the Buddha awakened to. It's the same. If Siddhartha Gautama awakened today and looked out on the world, he'd say exactly the same thing, I think, and I think all of you would. The world is a flame, isn't it? But the solution he taught, and this speaks directly to what you said, Mary, we want to do something. But the most effective thing we can do is to first take up the Dhamma and awaken, and then we'll be in a much better position to influence the world in that way. So we can get distracted by all the difficulties in the world, thinking, I got to do something right now, when the most important thing is to gain understanding. And it doesn't mean while we're developing an awakened mind that we should just not be helpful towards people. In fact, it means just the opposite. We should really cultivate helpfulness, but true helpfulness rooted in wisdom. I use this example a lot. The Christian Crusades and now the modern jihads are all rooted in an idea that I need to do something for this situation, but rooted in extreme ignorance, aren't they? And the amount of suffering that those types of things have done in the world is astronomical. But yet the actors believe they were doing something that was necessary. And that should give us all a caution. Let me wake up first. Mm-hmm. Along the way, I'm going to do what I can. Even in our political climate, I'm going to vote for someone who I think is helpful towards people. I'm going to try to live without having a huge impact on the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We do these things, but most importantly, the most significant thing we can do for anyone is to develop the Dhamma and awaken. Because then we will no longer be contributing to the suffering in the world. Does that help, Mary?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is such an important thing. There's so much going on right now, but again, it's very similar to what it was 2,600 years ago. It's hard to not feel like I shouldn't even be meditating. There's too much suffering going on in the world. But that's the trap. That's the trap of the world. If we remember the First Noble Truth, the Buddha stated 2,600 years ago, suffering's going to occur as a consequence of having a human life. There's going to be just these kind of things that we're experiencing that we wish would be different. You might be someone who wishes there was a different president, or someone who wishes there was a different House of Representatives, or etc. But we accept it because it's what's occurring. We don't have to lose our minds over it. and all the other things. We might wish that our children were a little bit this or a little bit that, or that we were. You know, all my life, I'm 63, and I still think one day the Yankees are going to call and say they need a center fielder. But it's not likely, but, you know, I'm still holding on to I'm making a joke. We want ourselves and we want the world to be different than it is, and it can't be. Peace of mind, the Buddha's teaching says, understand that. Thanks for the question. It's an important one. So let's go around the room and see if you have any questions or comments, and we'll start with Jen.
Thank you. It's good to be here. So Mary's question kind of pointed to something that I've sort of been thinking about, and how the first noble truth, which is suffering occurs, is kind of a dense concept in the Dhamma, because in order for it to be suffering, there has to be an ego judging it. There has to be that aspect of mind that is saying it's bad and reacting to it. And so you have to recognize that. And you have to say, that's me judging it, or that's ego judging it. That's the mind judging this situation as bad. It's a phenomenon that's arising and passing away. My judgment of it being bad is anatta. Mm-hmm. So then, if your intention is, I have to change this so I can feel better about the situation, that is unskillful. But if you can say it's a phenomenon that's rising and passing away, and your intention is, I'm going to do whatever I can to be skillful in this situation and still be at peace, or not still be at peace, but enter it into it in from that place of peace, you will be far more skillful.
Yes.
Because you're not, it doesn't have that urgency behind it. It doesn't have that panic that's gonna cause panic in others. If you can approach it in a calm and peaceful way, you will be more skillful in doing whatever it takes to make the situation as good as it can be.
That's great.
So I don't know if I can, yeah.
There's no antagonism arising from self-identification.
Mm.
In other words, I think this should be different, and you must change. It just doesn't work, does it? But we've been trying to do that forever. Through legislation, through armies, you know, through taking over whole classes of people.
Mm-hmm.
When the Buddha counseled leaders during his time, even leaders that were planning to go into battle, the Buddha understood that he can't say, oh, you can't hurt anybody, because that's wrong, because it would be foolish. It would fall on deaf ears. It's an act of wrong speech. Even though the sentiment is right, we shouldn't be killing other people. But wisdom says that's not going to happen in this case. So what he would do, he would counsel these kings and other leaders that when you win, because he knew they had the stronger army, when you overtake the next town, treat them fairly. Give them enough goods to live. You know, he would counsel them on how to be a good leader, rather than saying, oh, you can't hurt anybody. Again, it's just realistic. Our ideology would say to rail against people hurting other people, and systems and policies that do the same. But yet that's an aspect of dukkha. With a very well concentrated mind and a mindful presence, we can have a positive effect. I don't know that we're ever going to end suffering in the world, though. But from understanding our suffering, it allows us to understand the nature of my own personal suffering. Now I can understand yours, and I can understand the suffering in the world from a much more realistic way, rather than just take an ideological point of view. Some ideological points of view are also a compassionate view. But if they're rooted in ideology, there's always going to be stress and suffering and antagonism there.
It's really just being concentrated yourself and then helping others be concentrated so they can focus on the task at hand.
Yeah.
Whatever that
is. It's just that. and continuing to maintain a peaceful and calm mind. So, thank you. Lauren, I'm going to skip over you. I want to get to Bruce. And just because they're going to have to leave in a few minutes, and I wanted to give you a chance to say something. Bruce, welcome to our Sangha this morning. How was your meditation in your class?
The meditation was wonderful. It's nice to come here and be still for 30 minutes. Just enjoyed listening to this and just kind of absorbing and taking it in. I love the thought about seclusion and taking that out into the world. I really resonated with that. I could feel that, how that can be brought out into the world. So enjoyed hearing about that. And it's just kind of allowing it all to sink in, and I know a little bit about all of this, but only a little bit. So it's nice to be here and kind of see where it brings me. Let's see where the path leads.
Yeah, I'm so glad you joined us today. Victoria, how about you? How was your meditation in the class?
It felt very good to sit and be still and feel, which is actually, I have a question around the discussion that we're having in the seclusion and trying to bring it into the body. So I'm trying very much in my life to understand this idea of seclusion or staying centered when the phenomena feels very overwhelming around you. And I'm wondering from on a somatic level, what the practice feels like so I can connect with that feeling in the very moment when it potentially is overwhelming.
Wow, what a great question. You got to keep coming. that's a quick answer, and excuse me for being a little flippant, but it really is that. You have to keep coming or keep applying it. But we know that to use a slightly exaggerated phrase, we know we've lost our mind when we're no longer calm. And that's the telling thing. And another way of saying that is we have lost restraint when our minds are no longer calm. There's a whole series of articles on the wisdom of restraint on my website that you can, so you understand that. But it is at our five physical senses and that sixth sense of consciousness, ongoing thinking, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that we practice restraint. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Often when we don't catch ourselves doing that, and most of us can't, especially initially, and we find ourselves caught up in the world, entangled in the world, often the only thing we can do is to find seclusion, sit down, meditate for a while, and start integrating the Eightfold Path so that when we're back in the world, we're carrying that seclusion from our cushion into the world. And so we're interacting in the world in a way that we're maintaining concentration and refined mindfulness without getting entangled in the world. But that's the crux of the problem. You know, that's why the Buddha taught this. Again, he didn't teach any. The Buddha never saw himself as a savior. He didn't try to teach a salvific religion. He taught a very simple but profound way of living in the world without being entangled in the world and keeping your mind united in your body. Whenever you feel stress, your mind is no longer in its body. And this is, I'm using that as a phrase. Of course, our thinking comes from our brain and it's in our body. But as a as an establishment of where we are, a mind that is agitated, is distracted either to the past or to the future, or often both at the same time. And that's a mind that's not in his body, is it? It's here or there. It's not here. And so what a profound question you asked. So thank you. Thank you for joining us today. It's just about 4:15, so I know you have to run. If you go to becoming-buddha.com, you can sign up for my newsletter. And I send it out Mondays and Thursdays, describing the classes that week and a link to an article in relation to that. So I hope you continue to join us.
Yes. Are you for today, or to take care of Matthew? Or?
There's a donation basket right on the other side of the door. It only takes $100 bills, but it's all right.
That's all we got.
It's so nice to meet you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great to see you again, Bruce.
Yes, you too.
Take care.
John, I'm going to take my leave too, so it's not as disruptive in a couple minutes.
Well,
thank you for this talk. It's been great. There's another paradox I think about it. We come to the Sangha and we're together, but we're secluded together. And it's sort of we can find that place together. So just a contradiction, or not a contradiction, but a paradox that makes such a lot of sense.
And thank you for that.
The place where in the beginning of this sutta, he talks about let's go to a place. From people from all walks of life can be there.
That
is the Sangha.
Yep.
And here we are.
The great guest house, which is a refuge for anyone who wants it. And the seclusion that we've established here by focusing only on what the Buddha taught. That's the nature of seclusion, isn't it? We all know when we come here, we're going to be doing one thing. We're going to develop the Buddha's Dhamma. And it works, doesn't it? Thank you, Kevin. Good to see you.
See you in 2 or 3 weeks.
Aye. Yeah. Oh, I lost Frank, too. Okay. I was going to ask Frank. Lord, good to see you, Lauren.
It's good to be here. And I must congratulate you on your teaching, because I think we're all getting this down as clear as anything, which is not easy to teach. And I think you're just wonderful.
Thank you.
Talking about seclusion, which was a question asked on Tuesday night about what is meant by seclusion, which kind of prompted that. But I think that's kind of like stayed with me, understanding the seclusion that we need to develop against phenomena, maybe against isn't the right word, but and just understanding and being clear what is actually going on in the world and what is just going on in our heads.
Yeah.
Because we tend to believe what we think, and what we think, then we have feelings which support what we think, blah, blah, blah. And to see that clearly and have in mind what is going on in the world without my input, just what is going on in the world, is a kind of like a clear, touchstone you can just go to, which kind of like clarifies your mind and your thinking again, that you can see how we develop wrong thinking by misunderstanding what's going on and by being caught up in our thoughts and our feelings. And I've been conscious of that since last Tuesday, since that class last Tuesday when we looked at this again, the sutta. And so I've just, I can see that I'm thinking that the five clinging aggregates are at least two of them. The thoughts and the feelings are, well, more four out of the five I'm working on, and I think they're just like truly fizzling out, that I just don't believe in them like I used to do. I can
You don't self-identify as much.
I don't self-identify like I used to do. I don't believe in them, which is means they're impermanent, which is a wonderful realization that this is possible.
Yeah.
You know, what the Buddha awakened to is possible even for me.
For all of us. And it's this great freedom in it.
Yeah, and freedom and release, which is the great release that the Buddha talks about, that you're released from wrong view.
That's it.
And all that mush and tight thinking that we get into about ourselves and stuff is wrong view.
It is.
And we can release ourselves from that. Yeah. And I've kind of like just taken a bit of a step up in that direction this week since last Tuesday. But funny enough, my meditation and my cushion has like gone down.
Yeah.
But that's not to worry about. It's just there to be noted.
Yeah.
There are 8 factors to the Eightfold Path. We look at our meditation, I think, you know, very closely, kind of monitor ourselves on that. But I think if you take steps in the other aspects of the Eightfold Path, which I've mentioned in my understanding, maybe my meditation is not too good at the moment. That's just the way, it's not a linear path, we've said.
Yeah.
You know, you go up in one and down in the other. And I mean, it's to be noted that I'm not very concentrating on my cushion, it's to be noted, but it's not to stress over or...
Yeah.
It'll come back, you know. A blip is a blip and it'll come back again. So that's where I've been since Tuesday. Thank you.
Great wisdom there. Yeah, it's just what's going on. As long as you maintain the method, that's right effort too.
Mm.
When meditation doesn't seem so exciting, what do? You meditate.
Mm.
Thank you. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning. Sutta reminded me of, and it's kind of funny like how the greatest people of all time have very similar sentiments to the Buddha. It's very much connected, even though they're in different times and different places. Like Epictetus said, it's not the experiences that make you upset, it's your viewpoint of those experiences.
Yeah.
And so much is within us, you know, that sometimes if I feel myself getting into a negative place, I'll just, the thought that I'm enough can bring me back. You just say, you know, I'm enough. I don't need to be impressing anyone here.
Yeah.
I don't need to be judging people. You know, just I'm enough. And actually that reminds me like what Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. That's what he meant, that we're all enough. We don't have to try to be something different.
Yeah.
And that grounds you and brings you back to getting out of a judgment mode or a criticizing mode,
yeah,
or an angry mode. And when you were talking about the eye-making and the perception of self, I was starting to think, wow, the self really is a moving target. Because when you think you know it changes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it always wants more.
Yeah, and I like that you said target, because I sometimes get caught up in one.
It shouldn't be a target, but
no,
we make it a target.
Yeah,
and it's always moving, so we can't hit it.
Yeah.
Even on a microscopic level, like our cells are changing. There's probably 84,000 new cells in my body during this alone. Not to say you talk too much, but... you know, so it's wonderful to be reminded of these things. And I don't know the 5 clinging aggregates. I'm sitting here thinking form, feeling, but I don't look at it that way. It's easier for me to look at it at a general level and just say, what am I feeling right now?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I can see that, I can realize that that there's some judgment there. Something's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and just pull back from that.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes that happens and I can figure it out.
Yeah, it's just that direct.
Yeah.
You know, but we need the presence of mind, the concentration in order to do that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Anthony. Good to see
you.
Becky, good to see you. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so glad to be here, be back.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back.
And there's so many things jumping around in my mind. First of all, I want to say that I listened to the recording of Tuesday night, and I heard Lorna's question. And as I continued to listen, I started to get it, but not really what we call in our family of teachers. I didn't feel it. I got it intellectually, but I didn't internalize it. And being here and having you explain it and bring it back up again has been, I learned so much. That's so helpful, just to think of your concentration that you are working on, to realize that that's what you do with it when you're off your cushion. And that that is just so profound. I mean, something that it's just a concept that I hadn't fully realized or integrated, not haven't integrated it yet, but that I didn't fully realize. And then when Mary asked about being able to do something about it, I understood your answer and it was clear. But then when Jen said, what you do when you're living the Dhamma and you're concentrating in a secluded way is you realize when you're agitated and when you want to react. But if you can stop that and go back and say and realize where that's coming from, then you can affect the situation at hand in a skillful way that will cause you to have a positive impact that didn't, you know, blow up, that didn't, it just, so many things came together today. I'm just, wow, I'm just so glad I came.
I'm glad you came too. I mean, you've put your time in too to understand this,
well,
but that's the nature of this.
Another thing I was feeling,
Kandana.
What's the word? Not really being hard on myself, but I've been traveling a lot this winter, and so my meditation practice has been not what it usually is, and so I was like, wow, you know, I just have to get back, but maybe, you know, I don't know, it just, maybe things were ruminating in here while I was doing something else, and it just came all together. So anyway, thank
Great.
You.
Yeah, and that's just the way it is. Yeah, you have to put your time in. You've learned enough of the Dhamma to put this particular talk into context.
Exactly.
And that's just how it works, you know. So, I mean, you have a brilliant teacher. You're lucky about that.
That's true. That is so true.
It's just such a
Thank
good...
Thank you, John.
And a humble one,
That's what I get for being self-aggrandizing. It's just that the Dhamma is just that way. To me, the brilliance in the Buddha's teaching is that he understood how to present things in a way that we can integrate them without too much difficulty and solely by a lot of repetition. I mean, that's how he designed the Dhamma, to keep going over these things to pierce that veil of ignorance, and we have these little aha moments along the way. You know, if you heard this sutta 2 years ago, it would have been probably useless to you, because you didn't have the context. But it would have been useful in other ways. I'm sure it was useful to Nick and to the other new folks, because it starts pointing in a direction. So
it does.
Thank you. Nick, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation in your class this morning?
Well, the class was fine. I'm trying to... I'm in my infancy, so I'm just starting this.
Yeah.
So it's a lot to process. But something happened when in my meditation, and I started feeling anxiety, and I was able to have the anxiety pass, but I didn't know why I was having the anxiety, and I'm wondering if I should have done something to find out what was causing it.
No. In fact, you did exactly what you should. You did, for one thing, you didn't empower the anxiety by trying to do that, figure out where it's from and who's to blame or what's the situation. In meditation, it's a practice of deepening concentration. So whatever is distracting us, including anxiety, we come back to the sensation of breathing. And you also had a very profound experience of impermanence. The anxiety passed without you doing anything, didn't it?
Yes.
That's the power that anxiety has over you, none. Except when it has control over you. You know, and if you can keep developing that well-concentrated mind, it won't have that effect anymore. But again, if you used your meditation to get into where and why and how, you would have lost the whole point, wouldn't you? So what a great lesson and a great meditation you had. How was it meditating for 30? Have you been meditating on your own for 30 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, so it wasn't a stretch for you either, so that's good.
Could I ask Nick a question?
Sure.
Was it physical anxiety or mental?
No, both. I
it's the nature of the beast.
It started everything, and I told John this whole story, but it started 2 months ago, and to a point where I was getting chest pains and pain in my arm, and I thought I was having a heart attack, and I went and got EKGs and everything else, and they said, no, you're having an anxiety attack. I said, okay, all right. So that's when I started working on trying to control my anxiety, which has been very difficult for the past 2 months, but that's where I'm at right now. But it is, yes, it's both mental and physical anxiety.
So like what John said, the best thing to do is just to accept it. If I get it, I label it, I go, oh, there it is again, there's anxiety. And if it's physical, I just kind of try to meditate on that. You know, like I'll just go, okay, you're following your breath. This is the breath, it's fast. Okay, that's what it is, you accept it. If I had a sensation, like does it ever have tingling anywhere?
Yeah.
I would just imagine that's tingling. What does it look like? What does it feel like? And I would just be curious about that physical symptom. And that's what makes it go away the quickest.
Well, whatever.
But when you fight it, it gets stronger. And when you resist it, there was an old saying, what you fight, you strengthen. What you resist, persists.
Mm-hmm.
It's the, you can't, like the old, people think they can muscle through it because that's kind of the American way. You can beat that up. It makes the anxiety go stronger. So just accept it, feel it, and meditate to that symptom or that thought, and just let it pass.
Mm-hmm.
Like any other thought, right? Like a cloud in the sky. You just see
it
and you
watch it
pass.
Whatever the distraction is, you come back to the, in meditation, in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, whatever's distracting you, whether it's a physical sensation or a thought construct, you simply recognize that you're distracted and come back to the sensation of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that, when you look at it that way, the physical pain or emotional distraction is all fodder for deepening concentration. Always just, the meditation method is come back to the sensation of breathing. Because once you get into something else, you no longer have a concentration practice. You're attempting to some type of therapy, which is fine, but you're taking away from your concentration practice when you do that. It sounds like you did it perfectly today.
Yeah.
Okay. Good
and
for you.
Yeah, it'll arise and it will pass away on its own without any input from you.
Yeah.
And the more you recognize that, the more comfortable you'll be with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it just takes continued practice.
Yeah.
I think everyone would say that. So
meditation's a great
for
thing
sure.
for anxiety, though, because I thought anxiety is definitely in the head, and meditation gets you out of the head.
Yeah.
Because when you're focusing on the breath, you can't think. You literally can't do it. If you're actually focusing on the breath coming in under your nose, try to think, you can't do it.
You can't do it.
Two things at one time.
And a well-concentrated mind, this relates to the seclusion, too. A well-concentrated mind that's established on our meditation cushion out in our moment-by-moment life is a mind that is free of anxiety. A mind that is rooted in anxiety is a distracted mind, isn't it? A well-concentrated mind isn't. And it's just that practical and that direct. So that's why I promised you when we first started talking that if you do take to this practice and develop it and put your right effort in, it will help you greatly. It helped me. I mean, I used to be full of anxiety. And,
me too.
That's what brought me here.
Me too.
I mean, I was on medication for it. And, you know, I'm not. I mean, that's many, many years ago, but it's because of this a meditation practice. And just to quote, I'm not saying stop everything else you're doing either. Develop this practice very gradually keep talking to, I forgot her name, down at...
Dr. Meyer,
yeah. She's such a... Please tell her I said hello.
Okay.
You know, and, good to see you, Nick. I'm glad you came today, and hopefully you can get back on Tuesdays and Saturdays. And, you know, like
is, that. Is the Tuesday class going to be the same as this one, or is it, does it move on?
Tuesday's class will have a different topic, but hearing it twice doesn't hurt either. Is,
you know. I come twice a week, and often John does the same. I mean, for instance, I sat through this class on Tuesday, and I realized one or two things which I've spoken about today, and today I've realized one or two more things, because if you get one piece of the Dharma, then you move on. But even if you hear the same class, because you've got the previous one, you can move on and get something else from the same class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I found that, you know, that time and time so never, as I said too many times, don't worry that I'm sitting through the same class again, because I get something out of another class.
It's just that way.
Yeah. And different people, and you know.
I've written that on just this sutta. Obviously, I wrote it. I didn't write the sutta, but I wrote it into an English version appropriate to dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. But I've taught it 3 or 4 times now, and every time I see something new in it. You know, it's just, the Dhamma is just that way.
Yeah.
Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. I think this was an excellent class, and it just, you know, it drove home a lot of points. But again, like you said, all of the suttas drive home different points depending on different frames of mind that you're in at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something for everyone in all of them.
Yeah.
I found this very useful, and I'm glad to hear I'm not the only anxiety queen in the room.
I think we all are. That's the nature of stress, isn't it? To create anxiety in us. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Even when you read of Siddhartha, while he was a young boy growing up, and then his search for awakening, there's a lot of anxiety in it. You know, and it comes across even in these writings from 2,600 years ago. It's just the nature of human life when you don't understand what's going on. And that's a natural cause for anxiety, isn't it? To live a life when you don't understand it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you be anxious?
Well, yeah, I think it also, when you don't accept it, that adds to the anxiety.
Oh yeah.
And you have to understand that accepting it doesn't mean that you agree with it. You simply, it's happening. It's just what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, and ultimately, it's ourselves that we don't accept. And that's almost, it's part of our Western culture too. That it's almost a subtle but pervasive. I don't even know the right word. A subtle but pervasive view that it's not healthy to think well of yourself in a realistic way, not in an arrogant way. But why not? If we understand who and what we truly are, why should we beat ourselves up? When we understand that all of us as human beings, no matter what our situation, no matter what our race, our color, or all the things that people are concerned, the sexual orientation, the politics, whatever our political bent is, no matter what, all of us are just 6 elements and nothing more. As much as we want to paint this body, we can't. As much as we want to ornament those 6 basic properties, we can't change any of it. So why don't we accept it? And why don't we see things clearly? There's nothing to take personal. But that doesn't get back to what you were talking about, Mary. It doesn't mean that there's not things that are very difficult to not take personal, but there's nothing personal in the world. Why? How can I make that statement, or the Buddha make that statement 2,600 years ago? Because even the things that we are taking as egregious harms towards me or towards society are all rooted in ignorance, which means there's no real substance. So why get to the point where I'm losing my mind over something that ultimately doesn't have any substance? What it needs, what the problem needs, is understanding or wisdom. That's what the Buddha realized. That's his profound understanding. There's nowhere in the so-called 84,000 suttas that the Buddha gave post his awakening where you see the Buddha protesting anything except ignorance. And that he protested vehemently, moment after moment after moment.
You know, that's one of the things that helps me accept the political situation and a lot of other things the most, is to realize that people operating from their highest level of consciousness,
that's right,
they don't know any better.
They
and
don't,
that even includes our president.
It does.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
And you know, this may sound almost bizarre, but a mind rooted in ignorance will always do what it thinks is best for itself, meaning that all of these actors that we have in the world today, especially the great divide between one side and the other side, are all acting from what they think is best, even though at times it's so very hurtful. So what does that tell us? It points directly to ignorance. Mm. It's the only thing that would support that type of views and behaviors, is it? So there's it brings instant understanding and compassion, so where I don't lose my mind over something the president might say or something Nancy Pelosi might say or other things that go on in the world. I mean, that's not the only thing that's going on in the world, is it? It's the United States politics. There's a lot of stuff going on. There are two things happened. I happened to catch this on my news. I saw what's the president's, the guy that was running the Manafort. And they showed him on screen, and you know, I forget about he did some pretty bad things, you know. And in our system, I agree he should go to prison. But what a sad thing to see, just see this human being and the pain that he was in. And then the next thing they went to, I can't remember if I was watching. I watch CNN and Fox, because then I figure out somewhere in the middle is probably the truth.
Boy, that's hard to watch Fox.
Yeah, well, to me it's hard to watch both of them. But
yeah, I agree.
R. Kelly and what a brutal man he was, and he certainly deserves, in our system that we have, he deserves punishment or whatever that's going to be. But again, it was so sad to see this human being like that have lost his mind and then to justify his behavior. So what am I trying to say? There's a lot of things we can be against in this world, and certainly that, you know, people like Kelly and Manafort cheating and all these other things, they're not things that we should approve of, but we should accept them, because then we can see beyond the situation and at least see the human being that are, well, they're suffering.
That's, yeah, you're right.
I mean, they really are. And what can we, there's not much any of us are going to do about R. Kelly or Paul Manafort, their immediate suffering. You know, I don't think we're going to go visit them in jail or anything like that.
Yeah, right.
But, and we probably shouldn't, because there's some tacit approval given there. But what we can do is understand it and not hate them, which is what, and I guess that's the point I'm making, because what the media was trying to generate in me directly was, look at these people, you need to hate them now.
Yeah, that's what
or
I
Or there's
mean,
something
yeah.
wrong
mm-hmm.
with you. And
yeah.
that's what I, that,
that's
to me,
what
that's
I
what's
mean.
Really offensive. And that's what,
yeah.
that's what creates further hatred in other people. And they justify it because, well, they told me to act this
yeah.
way.
I have
and
a
that's
hard
what,
time.
Well, are they suffering because they did something wrong? Or are they suffering because they got caught doing something wrong?
Well, probably because they got caught, but it's, to me, that's the same suffering. You know, even if you didn't get caught. In other words, Paul Manafort, by his actions, was suffering all this, you know, his whole life to do those things. That, whether you get away with something or not, there's no free rides. And people like R. Kelly, you can't get away with anything. But I agree, they're probably suffering more because they got caught, etc. But, you know, they're still suffering. And the nature, and it's not that they should suffer because of the awful things they did. They're suffering because of ignorance. That's the
right.
important thing. There's the root cause for this, and then there's what they did out of it.
Mm.
You know? And and so I understand, and I can have compassion for people like that, because I understand where it came from, the same ignorance that I suffered with for many years. And I think that's where we can, it's not likely to happen, but as a Sangha, we can, not unite, we can understand what's going on in the world as a Sangha from that point of view, that it's ignorance that's causing all these issues. And if we remember that, that only helps encourage our own practice to recognize and abandon ignorance. Great class. Any other questions or comments before we finish? Okay, our retreat is coming up May 16th. What am I looking for? Oh, yeah, this. we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.